tricky subject that if you aren't reading through the chapter with some care, figuring out what doesn't make sense and either making sense out of it or asking about it, you're going to have problems that it's not going to be very useful information to you 5 years from now or 10 years from now when you really need it. Yeah.
We had 4.1 to 4.4 that
you
started with, correct?
Yeah.
But 4.1, 4.2, I think only had to do with like balance sheets and some other stuff. But you on
balance sheets, income statements, and cash flow statements.
But on the midterms you have posted, you only had questions about T charts?
That may be the case, but I think part of understanding why T-charts are what they are depends on making sense of balance sheets. That is, it's sort of...
I don't know what's going to be in the midterm this time. Let me put this to sleep since I'm not using it yet. No point in having it.
But it's sort of an interrelated system, and I think if you don't understand all the pieces of it, none of the pieces make much sense if that...
My question is, if we have questions on the midterms,
yes,
that go outside of the historic scope of the questions,
yes,
can we connect T-charts with balance sheets, with cash flow statements? Because I don't really understand how they connect very well.
All right. I think that would be worth understanding. I agree.
Let me see. We have... balance, we have income, and we have cash flow. All right? Three categories. And then we have T-charts, which we'll get to in a minute. Balance sheet shows at a given instant the condition of the firm. Income statement shows over a period of time the sum of the things that have changed that condition. So it shows how over, say, a period of a year, your assets have gone up, or your liabilities have gone up, or you've gotten income, various things have happened, which are why the balance sheet's different at the end of the year than at the beginning. Cash flow, logically, is not of any importance, but in practice is, because what cash flow is a particular subset really of the information on the income statement having to do with money. And in principle, money is just an asset like any other asset. But money has the useful feature that unlike many other assets, it is easily measurable and evaluated. And therefore, if the company tells you we've been having income much higher than expenses for years, and you observe they don't have any cash, you at least ought to be suspicious. Because you can think it's, in a sense, easier to find ways of making your assets look bigger than they are than find ways of making your cash look bigger. In addition, even if they're perfectly honest, assets that take 2 years to convert into money don't solve the problem of paying your bills next month, whereas cash does. So, logically speaking, this is really less important than those two. But there's a reason why people record it.
All right.
So, on the balance sheet, the critical thing, really, is what they refer to as the fundamental equation of accounting. You've got, over here you have assets. Here you have liabilities. And here you've got something that's, roughly speaking, equity. Although there's a different term for a nonprofit. All right? And the critical thing, which explains why T accounts have the weird form they do, is that this has to equal the sum of these two. That's the fundamental equation. All right? A different way of putting it is, suppose you take the total value of everything that the company owns, minus the total value of everything that it owes to people, minus the claim that stockholders have. What's left? Nothing, right? The company belongs to the stockholders. So that means that if assets are larger than liabilities, that difference is the equity. All right? If assets are smaller than liabilities, that means equity is negative. Make sense? So this is getting a little ahead, but one of the points I was going to make when we get to T accounts, a T account shows a single event and the numbers that are eventually going to end up in these on these things. So you have a single event, which is, let us say, I probably got room to do it here. Your single event is buying some oil, buying something, and it's going to affect two different accounts. It's going to affect your cash. And your cash is going to go down by, let us say, $1,000. And your inventory, which is going to go up by $1,000. And the nature of T accounts is that those always balance. That any time you've got on one side of the line some number, you've got an equal number on the other side of the line. All right? And that ought to suggest a puzzle to you. What's the obvious puzzle? If I tell you that debits and credits always balance, what should you say? Why does that sound crazy? Because you never make any money, right? But note that the credit side includes both liabilities and equity. So the credit. That's why debit and credit, one of the reasons why debit and credit are even more confusing terms than they might be. It would be bad enough if credit meant something that made you worse off and debit made you something better off. But it isn't that simple, because what actually they mean is debit means anything that goes on the left-hand side of the T account, and credit anything that goes on the right-hand side. And you will be well off forgetting the terms debit and credit, just thinking of left-hand side and right-hand side. And you will notice that these are in reverse alphabetical order, which makes perfect sense given how crazy the whole system is. All right? If we now say what goes on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, what goes on the right-hand side has to be things that balance what's on the left-hand side if we're going to have this fundamental equation keep working, if these numbers are always the same. Because it's the fundamental equation that's the reason why you're always putting in numbers of the same size on both sides. Make sense? Yes? So that means that if the numbers don't balance in terms of assets and liabilities, then the surplus or deficit is going to ultimately end up in equity. And the way it does so, which is a little complicated and I didn't work out when I was first trying to go through this 4 years ago or so, is through income. So that logically speaking, let us suppose for a moment that that $1,000 bill drops out of the heavens and flutters down onto the front yard of the CEO's office. All right. So, cash, debit, i.e., left hand side, i.e., good stuff, $1,000. Now we need something else to balance that. Well, logic. Really what balances them, it's not the way it's done, is equity. $1,000 increase in equity. All right? But in fact, the way they do it is there's an income statement. $1,000 there. And to answer your question of how the T things tie in, at the end of the year, you calculate up your income statement in which you are adding up all of these plus expenses, which are like this, but on the other side. All right? Put all of those in, add them up, you get an income. That then changes your balance sheet and gives you the end of the year balance sheet. Does that make sense? Yeah. At the same time, of course, everything, all of this is true of all of these things. At the end of the year, there are a bunch of cash going up on the left-hand side, cash going down on the right-hand side. Plus 1,000 here, minus 500 here, plus 600 here, minus 2,000 here, whatever those numbers are. At the end of the year, you just add these up and you say, well, on net, we had a $900 T
decrease in assets. Cash is an asset, right? Fine. Go to our balance sheet, look at cash. The number ought to be $900 less than what's remaining here. Does that make sense? Do that for everything. You've got one of these for cash. You've got one of these for inventory. Inventory is going to end up on your balance sheet. What you're putting in is not gallons of oil, but dollars. Everything is in dollars or pounds if you're in England. All right? So this is here we increased our inventory. Increasing our inventory is a plus. So we increased our inventory by $2,000 worth of oil. We sold some of it, so we decreased it by $1,000. We bought some more, so we increased it by another $500. We sold some more, $1,000. Sum this all up, and what do we see? We see that inventory increased by $500. Go to our balance sheet, add $500 to inventory. At the beginning of the year, we have inventory at the end of the year. So what's happening is that all of the terms in the accounting originate with events. That's part of one of the rules of accounting is that the terms on the accounts are basically good things belonging to or owed to the firm, bad things owed by the firm, each of which is traced to some event. Each pair of T accounts shows a single event. And if you then take all of the T accounts that have the same thing at the top of them, like cash, well, in fact, it'll just be one. We can just keep writing down and each time something happens. But each entry on a T account, each pair of entries, this and this, that's a single event. All right? Does that make sense? And how do we know that we... No, actually, this is the wrong... Sorry, wrong side. That's a plus section. Well, I guess not. I guess this is we sold. So, right, this one we decreased our inventory by $1,000 and we increased our cash by $1,000. We sold $1,000 for the oil sale. And how do we know that the numbers are the same? Because this isn't gallons, it's dollars. And now, they don't have to be the same in one sense. It could be that we sold it for more than we paid for it. All right, this is in at original cost. But in that case, we can take care of that by having another entry down on the income statement where one term here, which was the income of the extra, of the total money, I guess. And I'm not sure somewhere you're going to have to have a minus. You have to have a term balancing the 2,000 here and a term on the left side of some part of it, I guess expense of doing business or something. Cost of producing it, which was the 1,000. Does that make sense? Yeah, I guess that's right. So imagine that we bought our oil. Let me erase the rest of these and run through that imaginary example because I think it may clarify things a little bit. We buy some oil for $1,000. So at that point, cash goes down by 1,000, inventory goes up by 1,000. Right? We then sell the same oil for 2,000. What happens? Inventory goes down by 1,000. Income goes up by 2,000, balancing the 2,000 cash here. And we've got another one like this, only this is cost of stuff we produce, some term like that, if we can call it. And that's got 1,000 here because the cost of earning that 2,000 was that we had to sell oil that we bought for it. Make sense? Does that work or not? It actually makes sense if you think about it long enough, but at first it often doesn't, so tell me when it doesn't, and we can go over things as many times as necessary.
Right, the underlying ideas are pretty simple, but they're sort of not initially intuitive. Every transaction produces two terms that balance. Income here, cash here. Inventory down by 1,000, cost of doing business up by 1,000, but notice that the things on the income statements have the opposite sidedness from what seems intuitive, that is this $2,000 is in what would be a loss if it were cash, but it's a gain if it's income, because because ultimately those income things are going to go across to the right-hand side of the balance sheet. Equity. Net increase.
Yes. Sure. As many times as necessary.
Because I found it confusing too when I started doing this. I mean, I've only known about accounting since the first time we bought this course 4 years ago. Other than that, it's a complete mystery. So let's run through that again. Let's call this one cost of goods. It's something like that. Because eventually we're going to have an income statement and it's going to have a positive statement for income. Subtract from that cost of goods sold. So I think the answer is that the way we handle the case where we make money on a transaction is that the first thing we do is we reduce an asset, cash, by $1,000 and increase an asset inventory by $1,000.
That's the purchase of
$1,000 worth of oil. Our good fortune, the price of oil goes up. So we are now able to sell it for $2,000. How do we make everything balance? Well, we have a reduction of inventory of $1,000. And that's balanced by a cost of goods sold of $1,000. Because in order to get our income, we had to sell oil that, for accounting purposes, was $1,000 worth of oil. That's what we paid for it. Meanwhile, what about that money we got? Well, cash just went up by $2,000. That money is eventually going to go to income, so it's balanced. All right? And now when everything is over, suppose this was the only transaction in the year, what would we see? We would see on our income statement, income $2,000, cost of goods sold $1,000, net $1,000. All right? So it then wouldn't be surprising that when we looked at our balance sheet, we would see inventory was exactly what it was before. These two cancel. But cash is up by $1,000. Alright, makes sense. So we finally have a balance sheet. Balance sheet shows $1,000 more cash and $1,000 more equity as a result of that $1,000 net income then going into the balance sheet. All right.
So does the income go in?
The answer is that the income goes into the income statement. Huh, that's an interesting question. But I think the answer is the income goes into the income statement, and the net from the income statement then ends up in the balance sheet. I think that's right. I'm pretty sure that's right. Again, I'm not the type. I believe that's the answer.
I just say, when I originally was doing this, it seemed to me that the obvious answer is that this should just have gone into equity, or the difference should have gone into equity somehow. But this is probably a tie either way, because if it goes into equity, would it be the $1,000 profit or the $2,000 income? Whereas this way, you've got both your income and your costs here, and when you write your income statement, you're going to need those two pieces of information. Right? Other questions? All right, let me go back to sort of my list of things I was going to say to be interrupted every time you have a question, which is just fine with me because I can't cover everything, and so we ought to cover the stuff that matters, which is what you don't understand. What you do understand, we don't have to explain. Unless you're wrong, of course. Sometimes I am. So, first general observation I made last time, but let me repeat this time because I think it's interesting, and that is that accounting depends on a bunch of rules for simplifying how you calculate. And that one of those rules is that, with a few exceptions, all assets are valued at cost. So even if you know that the land is worth five times as much as when you bought it, you still put it in your books at cost. And there's an exception, basically, as I understand it, for assets that have a very well-defined value. So if you've got shares of stock or government bonds, or if you've got a bunch of British money and you're doing your accounting in dollars, I think you'd use the current exchange rate, not the exchange rate when you acquire this. That's at least my understanding. But again, I'm not an accountant. I think that with that exception, the basic rule is things go in at their cost. And furthermore, in order to show up as an asset, it's got to be linked to a specific transaction. so that the fact that you got goodwill over a period of time by producing nice goods and treating your employees well and stuff like that is not going to show up on your accounts, even though it may be of real importance to the company. It must be something, an asset has got to be something resulting from a transaction that is likely to lead future benefits. So it's something of value to you. Not certain, after all, that oil might be destroyed by a terrorist before you get to sell it, but your odds are again. All right. And finally, as I mentioned before, again, with rare exceptions, all probabilities are one or zero. So that if you are probably going to lose the lawsuit, then you've got a, somewhere on your balance sheet, you've got a liability representing the expected cost of that. If you're probably going to win it, the liability goes to zero. And as I mentioned, there's a striking similarity between the rules of accounting and the rules of tort law. That tort law, again, treats probabilities as zero or one, that if you were more likely than not negligent, then you're treated as negligent. If you're less likely than not, you're treated as not negligent. Again, there are exceptions. There are, you know, some special rules. Ditto in regard to guilt. Forget about negligence. Did you cause the accident at all? If the odds are better than 50%, you caused the accident. If they're less than 50%, you didn't cause the accident. All right. And, of course, you've got a similar pattern, though with different percentages, for criminal law, that we don't really believe, if we're sensible, that somebody who was acquitted of a crime is innocent of his crime. Acquitted means we're not sure he's guilty. There used to be, and for all I know still is, a verdict in Scottish law called not proven. That's in between guilty and innocent. And in some sense, the English folks, you sort of like to know. If they're really sure he's innocent, I'd like to know that. But that's, we're supposed to pretend we think people are innocent when they've been acquitted. But in fact, if you look at how the legal system works, that isn't really what the verdict means. It means not proven. And similarly, if you think about damages in tort law, damages tend to be restricted to monetarily measurable damages. So if you are injured, tort law, and somebody else was responsible for it, tort law will be happy to give you your doctor's bill. If you can show that you lost 6 months of work and here's what your salary was, then I'd be happy to make that up. It's much more iffy to get pain and suffering. Not impossible. But tort law, especially I think traditional tort law, was somewhat reluctant to award money for things like pain and suffering because those things, I would argue, because those things are very hard to measure. And the extreme case, which I argue in my other course is evidence of the inefficiency of tort law, of common law in general, is what happens if you're tortiously killed? Let's go back a minute, because I want to use it in common law. So suppose we go back to the early 19th century, and it is someone else's fault that you are killed. What damages do they owe? Anybody know?
Someone else's fault that you were killed?
Yes.
They owe nothing to you. They owe pain and suffering to the parents.
Not in 1820, they don't. That's survivor statutes that were put in during, I think, the 19th century by state law.
And
that's right. That the theory of that is that your claim dies with you. That if they had badly injured you, you would have had a claim against them. But if you die of your injuries, the claim evaporates because you're the one who had the claim. And that's got to, from an economic standpoint, that's got to be the wrong rule, because one of the buttons of the tort law is people reasons not to do bad things, and it's not a reason. This is a reason why they should make sure if they injure you, they kill you. Right? That's not the incentive we want to give people. But the other part of the reason is how do you measure the value of a life? And it may make some sense for the law to say, if we can't measure it, we're going to pretend it's not there. And that's what, in a sense, accounting largely does. Now, it's worth noting that exactly the same asset that is invisible on your accounting if you created it becomes visible if you want it. All right? So imagine you buy a firm, or you buy a division of a firm, or you buy a trade name, or a trademark, or something like that. Now you have a basis for evaluating it. All right? Suppose you have a firm, and the only important thing that firm has is a trademark. If it was your trademark originally, not in the accounts. But if you paid $5 million to get the firm's trademark, that trademark is now a $5 million asset. Why?
high because there was an actual transaction at a particular time when you value that. All right? And I'm going to argue that basically these weird features of tort law and accounting more or less make sense for the same reason. Because the context in which you actually try to get the right answer to a question is the context where you're making a decision for your own actions. And therefore, you try to do the best job you can of figuring out what this cost me, what the effects were, and so forth. But in both tort law and accounting, you normally have two or more parties with conflicts of interest. One party in tort law wants the number to look big, one wants it to look small, the defendant and the plaintiff. In accounting, the people who are trying to buy out your firm want to argue to you that the firm isn't worth very much. They may want to argue to their stockholders that it's worth a lot. But in each case, it's a context in which the information isn't information that somebody is generating for his own use. It's information that A is generating for B and C to fight over, as it were. And you can see that that's a strong argument for preferring clear answers to right answers, as it were, if you have to choose between. That's not my book, but that's my interpretation of what's going on after trying to make sense out of it. All right, let's go back to a balance sheet. And the balance sheet, as I say, is a photograph of the firm at one instant. And the basic rule for the assets, though it's not very important, I think, is you go top to bottom according to how liquid they are. So that cash, at the end of the day, you can pay at any time. You have securities, they're almost as liquid as cash, you can sell them today. Accounts receivable. You know what accounts receivable are? It's money somebody else owes you. But it's short-term money somebody else owes you. It's not like you lent them $5,000 and they got to pay it back in 20 years. It's like they bought some stuff from you and you're expecting to get paid in 30 days or 90 days or whatever the rules are for how you sell it. And then as you go down, you get stuff like, there's some technical term, but basically things like land, buildings, stuff that is not very liquid, but is nonetheless nice. Liabilities, I believe they also use a similar rule, that if you, for example, have received goods and not paid for them yet. I forget the term, but there's a term in the book somewhere for that. That would be near the top because that's just like an accounts receivable. That's something you're going to have to do. Whereas on the other hand, your long-term borrowing is going to be down near the bottom. And equity, for reasons that are not all that clear to me, but it's again a convention, they tend to separate it out for a joint stock company into one, which is theoretically how much the stockholders contributed to the company in the beginning, and then a second term, which is everything else, which is basically retained earnings or something like that. Makes sense. The income...
Could you repeat how equity is sorted top to bottom?
Yes. Equity is, at least judging by the book, which is all I really know, is usually divided into two categories, although you could imagine dividing it further. Probably should divide it further than that. But what they're showing is that one category is the amount of money contributed by the stockholders initially. So you made an initial stock issue at $10 a share, and you sold 10,000 shares, so that's $100,000. Everything else you can think of as retained earnings. Everything else is profits since you started the company, therefore increases above that initial $100,000, minus dividends paid out to your stockholders, which is not retained earnings.
Makes sense?
So if you have a $1 million company, it's got 10,000 shares of stock sold at $100 each. $10,000, two shares of stock sold at $10 each. So it's got $100,000 of additional money put in by the stockholders, $900,000 of retained earnings.
Why wouldn't it reflect the current value of the the stocks, not by the holders, because I mean that's really
because then there'd be nothing else. That is, then if the market agrees with the accountants, there'd be nothing else, right? The market doesn't agree with the accountants, but of course, one of the ways that people decide how much they're willing to pay for stocks is by looking at the accounts. They're sensible. It's not the only thing they do, but one thing you do is you say, "Well, I don't think this stock is worth very much because look, if you look at the accounts, their equity's negative, or at least their equity is less than the amount treated by the stockholders, or much more." But no, that's the market capitalization of a firm is the total value of all its stock, and that certainly is for other purposes a much more interesting number. Yep.
So, sorry, this might be obvious, but why is it useful to know the amount initially contributed by the shareholders?
Copy. I don't know. If I had to guess, it's that that rule goes back to a time when inflation was close to zero for a long period of time, and when therefore it might be interesting to a stockholder to say that I make money from this deal. All right, and that nowadays, except for very new firms, it's a highly deceptive number because, of course, they contributed in $1910. You're now evaluating stuff in $2010, and therefore, in real terms, they contributed with something like 5 or 10 times what you're claiming they contributed. You see what I mean? So that's why it seems to me a sort of a silly thing to do, but it's less silly if you're in a world of stable prices. Because in that world, it at least is informative to know. But it's not all that informative even there, because of course they may have paid out dividends in the meanwhile. So you can have a company where you can say, well, they haven't done anything very well at all. Their retained earnings are zero. And so, yeah, they didn't retain them. They paid them out generously year by year. So in that sense, it's not that that interesting either. But the real answer is it's convention, and you'll have to find an accountant who could give you a better reason for the convention. But it did occur to me that you could imagine ordering it in teams of the seniority of the stock claimants, that after all, there are different classes of stocks sometimes. And the fact that if the company goes bankrupt, some stockholders may be ahead in line. That is, the company goes bankrupt, it's true at least with regard to their liabilities, but there's an order in bankruptcy of who gets the first claim. But that's not the same as the order here, because the order here is how soon they're due, not how certain they are. All right. So if I have a junior claimant who I owe money to in 30 days, he goes above the line to a senior claimant to whom I owe money in 60 days. So, but all of these, you think about how complicated a question it is. Suppose you say, how is the firm doing? That's a very, very complicated question for a firm of any noticeable size. Right. Amazon, if I remember correctly, lost money for like the first 10 years, something like that. Very successful firm. Doesn't mean the accountants are going to show you that it's very successful. So it's nice to have ways of summing up the available objective information, which will tell you something about what's going on. Make sense? Ways that don't depend on how plausible the talker is. Right? If the CEO of Amazon, at a point where they've lost money for 10 years, said, this is a wonderful deal, we're going to be the central web source for buying practically everything, and we're going to make money hand over fist, you would reasonably not believe me, even though he's telling the truth. On the other hand, if he says, if the CEO of Apple says, and by the way, our assets include $50 billion in cash, either you believe him or he's engaged in the illegal fraudulent savings. It's true. I assume cash doesn't literally mean paper money. It probably means interest bearing accounts that are highly liquid accounts. Other questions? Yes. All right. Let's see. So the income statement. Let's go back to the income statement. Means I should probably erase a couple of things to make life a little easier.
It's not two sides. Like the other thing is just a list of stuff. And you start out with income. $10 million, say. That came out of that those income T accounts. And then whatever they call cost of goods sold or some such phrase, which is the direct costs of the goods. It does not include the salary of the CEO, but it includes what you paid for raw materials, the wages of the workers who made it, and so forth. $7 million. So that nets out to $3 million. I don't remember the name of this term, but it's gross profit or something like that. And you then have indirect... Don't believe me on the terminology. I'm not an accountant. I'm describing what the words mean, and if you look in the book, they will tell you what the right terms are, but it's something like indirect costs, which is the CEO's salary, the rent for the office building, whatever things aren't attributable to selling that widget, or even widgets in general. Call that another million, say. So you then have a less gross profit, which is $2 million. You then have, I think, interest is the next one, as I remember. But you can look on the book; it'll tell you. It shows you. Suppose that's $500,000 this year. So that then gets you down to 1.5, and then any taxes that you expect to pay, and what's left is the amount of money you actually will. Have increased the amount by which you expect to have increased your total assets, your total equity, not your total assets, your equity, your assets net of liability, by the end of the year. All right? Makes sense? So if you look at, except that I don't think dividends are anywhere in this, because dividends aren't a subtraction from income, they're what you do with the income. So I misspoke. The amount by which your the total of the balance, if you take the equity, which is assets minus liabilities, if there weren't any dividends, the change in this from beginning of the year to the end of the year would be the last number here. But if you pay out dividends, it'll be that minus the dividends. All right? Make sense? Yes? No? Maybe? Can't tell. And then if you look at a cash flow statement, which was the... I keep thinking that if I actually want to be able to put these things up on a whiteboard for people to see, I ought to put them before I erase them. I'm not very organized about that, but ideally I'd like to set things up and... Ideally I'd like to set things up in such a way that... in such a way that people who aren't here can, in effect, get the class indirectly, including people who are here but were asleep or just follow something or for whatever other reasons would like a record. So I've just photographed that bit of it. Now let's take off my balance sheet and put in a cash statement. And sort of the first instinct might be to say, well, shouldn't the amount of cash increase or decrease by the income? But the answer is no, because the interest is paid. This is the interest that the company had to pay
for borrowed
money. Again, look, you can look at the book, because the people who wrote the book, I'm sure, were consulting with an accountant that I'm not, but I think I've got it right. All right, so for the cash statement, maybe I'll cheat and look at the book too to see which things I'm getting wrong doing this by memory. Gross margin is the term for the first of those things that I call gross profit, and then operating earnings was the next one down, and then you end up with net income at the bottom. So let me take a look at the cash flow. And what's basically happening is that you start out with net income, say $1.5 million
here, and that's right, and the income is the last.
Yeah. And you then say, what are the reasons why my cash, my change in my cash I have, might be more or less than that number? And you say, well, was some of our income informed other than cash? Well, accounts receivable. All right, if accounts receivable, I'm really just looking at the book, but if accounts receivable went up, that means that cash didn't go up by that part of our income. All right, remember that in the income statement, if we sold some goods and people promised to pay us $10,000 for those goods, that accounts receivable goes in the positive side column. That ultimately ends up in the income statement, but it's not cash, they haven't paid us yet. So therefore, you would subtract out any increase in accounts receivable. And you would add any decrease, all right? If people paid $10,000 that they owed us at the beginning of the year, and we only got $5,000 of additional money owed, then we'd have $5,000 more cash than income implies. Does that make sense? What you're doing is saying, in the very simplest case where everything was cash on the barrel end, then the change in cash would be your income. Let's go through all of the adjustments to make that not true. All right. So any increase in accounts receivable goes as a negative term here. An increase in inventory. All right. Notice that inventory is an asset. It shows up in there. So the increase in inventory is again good. I assume you all realize the parentheses is the accountant's way of saying negative, saying minus. That's because they have black and white and use red. Which is another way of showing minus, and using a minus sign would be too easily confused. It's not obvious stuff. What about depreciation? Well, depreciation went as an expense when you're calculating your income statement, but it didn't actually take any money out, right? Depreciation just means that your computer is a year older than it used to be. All right, well, it makes sense to think of that as a cost because the cost of buying the computer is spread out over that time. But if in our initial calculations we had a $25,000 of depreciation, we should then add $25,000. We've got $25,000 more cash than looking at the income statement would imply. All right, and you can just keep going down. If you go down the list on page 129, you can see how all of that goes, and then there are some additional terms which are sources of cash, where the source of cash doesn't go into your income, because at least in these accounting, they're showing the net income from operating expenses. So if you also had money coming in because you owned some interest-bearing securities or something, you could have that. But also here, you might also have changes in cash, what's down there at the bottom, due to things like borrowing money. All right? When you borrow money, that doesn't show as something on your net income because you've gotten a $10,000 extra cash and a $10,000 liability because you owe someone $10,000, but it affects your cash holdings. So if you run down the table on 129, figure 4.4, you'll see that there they have short-term and long-term debt borrowing, increase your cash, an issue of capital stock, or you sold another 5,000 shares of stock at $10 a piece. On the other hand, the dividends that you paid reduce the amount of cash you have, and then you put in all of those together, and you end up with what happens to the total amount of cash you have. All right? So it's just, you could think of it just as a way of checking your numbers, as it were. You're saying, all right, we can see how much cash we have because we know the bank balance. Well, what should it be? We claim you made this much money. How come the bank balance is not up that much? Ah, because some of that money was made in the form of an increase in the value of our inventory. We now have more oil. Oil doesn't show up on your bank account. On the other hand, there's more money than there should be. Well, that's why we borrowed $20,000 this year. That doesn't show up in debt and so forth.
So it's a way, instead of looking at what the, in a sense, really matters, ultimately, it's a way of looking at the most easily measurable part of what really matters, namely the actual money.
All right.
And checking that that fits the rest of your numbers.
Questions? Not questions? Yeah. I think I left my notes over here for now.
Just those are not my notes.
No, something I should have thrown out. Those are my notes from several classes back. For some reason.
All right, so now let's go back to the T accounts for a minute and see if there are any questions about T accounts. I've gone through most of it, and as I say, the useful categories are left-hand side is stuff that increases your assets, decreases your liabilities. Right-hand side is stuff that decreases your assets, increases your liabilities, or increases your equity. All right?
You say that again?
Yes. Left-hand side is stuff that increases assets or decreases liabilities. Right-hand side is stuff that decreases assets or increases liabilities, or increases equity. Which also means that left-hand side could be decreasing equity. And increasing equity includes things like income received. Decreasing equity includes things like cost of goods produced. All right. So again, if you just remember the fundamental equation, which is that assets equal liabilities plus equity, that gives you a clue to what things are on the left side and what things are on the right side. If you think, if you sort of imagine, well, I guess that's, and remember that everything has to balance.
Make sense?
I
hope it makes sense.
Let's see what I'm
missing here. It occurs to me that one thing that seems a little odd sort of to a modern mathematical mind is that in the T accounts, they don't seem to use negative numbers. They just put it on the right side or the left side accordingly. And that maybe the double entry bookkeeping predates the invention of negative numbers. I wouldn't be surprised. It's about 1500. I don't know when people started thinking of the possibility of thinking that the number is minus 3 as opposed to just a subtraction. All right. So
I'm going to go on to look at a few hypothetical cases provided by the people who wrote this and see if we can work them through. But let me also suggest that you might, between now and next class, want to sort of look over the chapter and see if there's stuff that still doesn't make sense. It all makes sense during Christian. Mostly I find that if I look at it long enough, it doesn't make sense. So let's take a look at Joyce James Accounting. It even occurred to me that that was a play on words too. Joyce James Joyce Accountants. But this is one of their very fairly simple examples, which is designed to let you figure out if you know the stuff. Erase this while that this software is coming up. So, probably scroll this a little farther. Joyce James graduated from college in 2002. Why might she want to keep accounts, and what information might be most useful to her?
Feeling on that?
Imagine yourself as Joyce James. You've just graduated from college. You say various things. I'm going to be getting money in. I'm going to be spending money over the next few years. I'd like to keep track of it. Why might you want to keep track of it? What are some of the reasons to do so?
Want to buy a house?
Might might buy a house in the future and want to be able to show to the lender that she's got assets. She might want to keep track. I mean, one very simple question is, you could imagine somebody who has a hobby. She spends some money on the hobby. She thinks up is very small, but it's sort of a bit here, a bit there. It'd be nice to know how much of her income you're really going for that, especially if the hobby brings in income. This isn't this case. I'm thinking of other cases. But if you imagine somebody who says, it's all right to spend some money on woodworking tools because, after all, I make stuff to sell at the craft fairs. That would be sort of nice to know whether that's really paying for your woodworking tools or whether it's just an excuse. And you could think of other such cases. Or if you're saying, I'm following a certain pattern of behavior with borrowing money, making money, spending money, can I continue this? Are my debts going up or not? Well, if the answer is, well, yes, your debts are going up, but you're getting valuable assets, which could, with a little time lag, be converted into money, then you probably shouldn't be worried. I mean, after all, if you buy a house, your debt goes up a whole lot. That doesn't tell you that you're worse off. All right. So you can think of a number of possible reasons why she would want to do so. And you would think that probably what she wants is a balance sheet, that she probably wants to know in each instance, how am I doing? She might want other things as well. That seems like the simplest thing. But to get that, we use T-accounts, at least if Joyce wants to learn accounting, which maybe she does, maybe she's doing this for the fun of it, we'd like to know how we would handle these things. So let's start out with, she was awarded a prize of $5,000 for her senior thesis. So where is that going to go on T-accounts? What's the obvious place to start putting it? Cash.
Nice.
$1,000 bills.
Cash.
And that's here, and that's $5,000. But we can't let this sit here by itself. I mean, it's going to go boom, and the world will end because it violates the fundamental equation of accounting. So where else does that $5,000? Eventually, we'll get to equity.
That's right, income.
I would think that seems the obvious way to put it. Income. And again, note that on income, it's on the wrong side, as it were, because it is balancing this cash. All right. The next thing that happens is she spends $2,000 buying books. So where is that going? What are the two places where that's going to show up? Cash, that's a decrease in an asset, and where else?
Inventory.
You might call it inventory, or probably, actually, I would think of it more like equipment, because she's not actually going to sell the books, so let me call it equipment. So, there we call it, doesn't matter too much. Equipment, and that's going to be on this side, because she now has $2,000 worth of valuable books. That may have been enough to buy her two textbooks, even three textbooks. I keep finding it sort of bizarre how expensive textbooks are. You probably find it really bizarre and irritating. I don't have to buy the things, so. If your textbooks were available on a Kindle, would you take it that way? Assuming they're available and cheaper on a Kindle. I never used a Kindle, but I would have thought that as it's a big enough thing to read, that machine-readable stuff is better than hard copy because you can search it and make notes in it. We make notes in books, too, but you can't erase them very easily. All right. I'm just wondering whether the textbook market is going to change a whole lot in the next few years. What? Yes, that's right. And that would, on the one hand, mean that if they sold it, they'd have to sell it fairly cheaply, or they'd have to have some mechanism such as continuous updates that require that you're a licensed user or something like that. Yeah, no, I mean, if you're sort of thinking of entrepreneurial opportunities, figuring out how to adjust the publishing market to this rapid technological change is a really interesting thing, and someone's going to make a fortune out of it. But no, a friend of mine who's a very successful science fiction writer advised me that I should take a book I hadn't found a publisher for, a fiction work of fiction, turn it into a Kindle, put it up on Amazon. I can put it up for something under $10. 70% of the revenue goes as royalty to me, which is a whole lot more than a published book. So even though I would sell fewer copies, because it's not being promoted by a publisher, given that some people know my name, he thought I would make a respectable amount of money. I'm going to do the experiment to see.
agent, who's quite a good agent, agreed with him. So, which is why I'm doing it. But if they're both right, you could imagine a world where the successful authors are often people who are in effect self-publishing via something like Kindle rather than physical publishing. And then the question is, how would you, not an author, make a fortune in that world? I don't know. Maybe you should think about it.
Anyway, so So she spends $2,000 traveling through Europe and collecting the memories of a lifetime. What do you think? Where does that obviously have to go? Cash. So one thing that happens is $2,000 down. The other part's not so clear. Cost of operations, maybe, something like that. You could put it there. It would be something going along with income. Cost of operations. $2,000. How about all those valuable memories? Where do they go?
Nowhere.
Right. That's like goodwill. It's all of those intangibles that those hard-hearted accountants can't count on.
At the end of the summer, she took out a $4,000 loan to cover the costs of graduate school. The last thing I think that's constant for it. No, there's some more things. Is there another? I've got more things here, but they aren't on this on the PDF of music, so I'll just have to tell you the rest. I don't know why they've got a difference. Maybe there's another page I should have had. Anyway, so she. But the next thing she does is to take out a. Or is there? No, I get. Wait. At the end of the summer, she takes out a $4,000 loan. So where does that go? First cash, she's now back with a noticeable bank balance. Where else does it go?
Liabilities.
Well, debt, I suppose. I don't know. I don't remember what the proper term is, but her loan is down here, $4,000 loan. All right. And then I've got here. Yeah, I've got one more term, which doesn't seem to be on this one here. This is on my notes, which is she spends $5,000 on living expenses in graduate school. So where is that going to go? Cash is going to be down $5,000, and cost of operations, something like that. So now, when we take all of this together, what do we find her assets are? Let's now put this up a bit. I think we need that. Not a good idea. All right, let me erase over here. I have to go between things. What are her assets?
Cash is back down to zero, I think. Is that right?
No. 5, 9. No, she doesn't. 9 minus 9. She's back to zero. Right. What other assets does she have?
Books. $1,000. Memories. No memory. No value.
And what does she have? That's right. And so what does she now have as liability? What are her liabilities?
$4,000, I think it was.
$4,000.
Yeah. So what's her, if we think of her as a firm, what is her net equity?
Right.
$2,000 in the hole. But she's got all those memories.
And hopefully she learned something from graduate school.
So,
and the question is, does this accurately describe her real situation? And in deciding that, you might want to know what you know the what you want the information for. All right. Are you thinking about whether to loan her money or whether to marry her?
Or are you a parent saying, oh boy, have I made a mess of bringing up my daughter? Is she doing a terrible job of running her life?
Those are all reasons you might want to look at accounting somewhat oddly of doing these things. But if you were thinking about lending her money, those figures would suggest it's not a great idea. But you might have other information. You might say, yes, but she's an honest person. She's hardworking. She's getting a degree in something valuable. Her parents will pay off her debts if they have to. You can think of a lot of reasons why you might consider her a reasonable person to lend money to. But the sort of first approximation, as it were, is no, she's not very good financially. All right.
Let's try.
Let's go back a step for a moment. There are a couple of things which aren't, let me photograph this while I'm talking, there are a couple of things that aren't about this particular example, but that are probably worth talking about that are mentioned in the book that I haven't gotten to. And one of them, one of the ones which does involve a certain amount of judgment, which can be a problem, is what they refer to as the magic principle. And that is that that expenditures occur at one time, but sometimes they're really you spend money. Suppose you spend money now to pay for the rent of the office building next year. Or let me take my case for a moment. I finally got around to paying for a parking permit for this semester. So I'll be able to leave my home about 5 minutes later, starting probably a week from today, by which time I'll have the parking permit, because I don't have to worry about finding one street parking. Suppose for a moment that I was doing my accounting by the calendar year, and that I had made that payment in December, which I probably should have, but that's why wasted time finding parking for the first month or so of the semester. Well, where should that payment go? And the answer is, if we want to keep track of things, we'd like, if possible, to show that as an expense for this year, not for last year, because that's for this year that's getting the benefit. All right, so the magic principle really says that you try to move things in such a way that expenses and the associated income show up in the same calendar year, in the same accounting period. So if I do that, I can say, well, my cash went down by a couple of $100s, which is quite expensive as it turns out, but I have a prepaid expense, which is an asset of the same amount, so there's no net effect for my income or net effect for my balance sheet, as it were, from that in last year. And then for this year, the prepaid thing goes away because I've no longer prepaid anything, but I've got the service that I bought with it, and that's now an expense of doing business for this year. And the book discusses it in more detail, but the basic idea is that you are using things like prepaid expenses and a variety of other categories, which are used either to say, we aren't actually going to get the money till next year, but it really counts as if we're income this year, so that if you think about accounts receivable, your account, you sell something, you haven't paid for it yet, your accounts receivable will go up by $5,000, and ultimately on your balance sheet and on your income sheet, but not on your cash flow sheet, that $5,000 shows up in this year, even though the money only arrives next year. And next year, your cash goes up $5,000, your accounts receivable goes down $5,000, so there's no net effect. Make sense? But that's how you go about shifting income and expenses back and forth through time in order to properly pay. Note one problem which the book discusses, and to which there is no general solution, there are several solutions you can take, is
you've got a tank full of oil. Some of the oil was bought for $1 a gallon. It's up for $2 a gallon. You don't have little labels on the oil molecule saying $1 oil or $2 oil. So when you sell some of that oil, do you count it as a reduction in your $1 oil that you have? For accounting purposes, you've got 500 gallons of $2 oil in there and 500 gallons of $1 oil all mixed together. And one rule is what's called FIFO, first in, first out. This is also the same acronym is also used in computer programming for one of the ways in which you can organize stuff. You put numbers in, and the first number in is the one that comes out. FIFO is first in, first out. LIFO is last in, first out. So if it's FIFO, you say, all right, the first 500 gallons were $1 oil, so anything we sell up to 500 gallons, we count the cost of that, the value of the reduction of inventory, at $1 a gallon. After that, $2 a gallon. Alternatively, you could do LIFO, and you could say we will treat the last oil is in as the first oil out, since the last oil in cost us $2 a gallon. When we are doing our accounts and seeing what's happened to our inventory, 500 gallons of oil counts $1,000. Does that distinction make sense? And basically, all you really need, I think, is a consistent rule so you can't juggle it in ways that are designed to fudge up your numbers. Because there isn't really a right answer. I guess the economist's answer would probably be LIFO, in the sense that the cost to you of giving up a gallon of oil, if the price of oil is now $2, is $2, and you just had the good luck to make $1 a gallon, windfall profit when the price went up. But that's not the sort of thing you expect the economist to try to correct.
All right.
The depreciation is another part of the same process. You spend $10,000 for a computer system you expect to be good for 4 years. After that, you give to your kids to play video games on, because in 4 years there'll be much better ones for $10. And the $10,000, it doesn't really make sense to treat that as an expense for this year, because the benefits are going to be spread out over 4 years. So instead, you treat it as we spent $10,000, we got an asset worth $10,000, and we depreciated that asset by $2,500. And only that $2,500 is really a cost for this year. Next year we depreciate it by another $2,500, and so forth. Every once in a while I discover that my tax software has me taking a depreciation on something that I stopped using years ago. They're using some formula for how long you depreciate for. I put it in when I bought it, and that's it. I should say that one of the first couple of years I was teaching here, I discovered that the woman who was, I think, auditing my law and econ class was the wife half of the husband-wife team that had originally produced the software I'd been using to do my tax assignments. But that was sort of one of the extra benefits of Silicon Valley, is having students who are, from your standpoint, famous people, even if not from the standpoint of the rest of the world. I told her I wasn't sure whether she had done good or ill in the world, because she saved me a whole lot of work. On the other hand, the existence of tax-paying software reduces the resistance to more and more elaborate tax schemes, since you don't have all these people who are furious by April 15th at all the scribbling they've been doing. So it may be that if we didn't have the software, we would have lower and simpler taxes. But anyway, she wasn't a student here. What else do I want to say in the next few minutes? I've got another case, but there isn't time to do it. Maybe we'll do it at the beginning next time. Let me pass on points that actually I'm mostly getting from the book, which is, why do you as a lawyer care about all of this? And one reason is that contracts are often put in terms of accounting. That one of the things you want to be careful about if your customer has written a novel and someone's going to make a movie out of it, you'd like to be careful when they say that they'll give him 20% of the profits, just how they're defining profits in that contract, which is only in the accounting terms, because they might rig it in such a way that they can put costs that are really associated with running the studio in general wherever they please, and thus reduce profits to zero on their profitable ones, and thus cheat your customer. cheat your client out of money. So you want to be careful to what that profit was defined as. Right? You can think of a lot of other terms. Similarly, if your client is making loans, is either borrowing or lending money, accounting figures are part of what's going to be used in deciding whether somebody is a safe person for loan. Finally, maybe not finally, but at least publicly traded firms have legal obligations with regard to accounting. They're supposed to make information about the firm publicly available in various ways, and you as a lawyer may be giving them advice, not as to how accounting should be done, but as to whether what they're doing is consistent with their legal obligations, which is, after all, part of what you hire lawyers to take. Can you think of other things where you might, as a lawyer, want to know about accounting? There are probably ones I left out. So, yep.
Just tell me if this is wrong. So, unless he accounts for assets on the balance sheet, debits for assets increase.
A debit is an increase in an asset.
But if you have a credit for a equity item or a liability, then that will increase. That is,
the left-hand side shows increases in assets and decreases in liabilities. And the right-hand side shows increases in liabilities and decreases in assets. And the right-hand side also shows increases in equity or income, which is going to go to equity, and the left-hand side also shows decreases in that. All right? It really does make sense. It just takes a while. But this is really almost the only thing I've learned from this course. I guess I know a bit more about I mean, professors are supposed to learn from courses, too. That's the point of teaching courses, after all. And some of my courses, I can really exploit my students and learn lots of neat stuff. There's a book by a guy called Peter Leeson called The Invisible Hook, which is a book by an economist about 18th century piracy. And it's a lot of fun. That is, he really did try to look into the historical evidence on how pirate ships were organized, their firms, after all, how they acted, and so forth. I refereed, I think, two of the articles that went into that book and the book itself. Why was I confident to referee those? Because in my seminar on legal systems, very different from ours, students do papers. And two of my students had done papers on the legal institutions of 18th century pirate ships. So I'm serious when I say that part of the reason, if you're ever a professor, to teach courses is to learn stuff. And when you stop learning stuff, you should probably find a different course to teach, basically. But I did learn accounting from this course. And I think I understand contracting better than I would have if I hadn't. Because I think that chapter on contracting makes the points that were not obvious to me. So that's useful. But anyway. So I hope you end up... If accounting makes sense to you, that's really what you need. It's not like you have to know all the fine details. You can look those up whenever you actually are dealing with it. But as long as you understand what the left-hand side and the right-hand side are, and if you're sufficiently desperate, you can make some sense out of the term credit and debit, then you're in pretty good shape. All right?